On this episode of Know How, you're going to learn how to fix your DNS, and it's time for feedback.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Know How is brought to you by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com.
This episode is brought to you by Scotty Vest, technology-enabled clothing to carry all of your gadgets. Visit ScottyVest.com/TWiT now through February 24th to save 40% off 14 of their best sellers. That's ScottyVest.com/TWiT and use the code TWIT13 at checkout. And by Lynda.com. Learn what you want, when you want, with access to over 2,000 high-quality online courses, all for one low monthly price. To try it free for 7 days, visit lynda.com/knowhow. That's lynda.com/knowhow. Welcome to Know How. It's the TWiT show where we bend, break, upgrade, build, all that other stuff, right?
Yeah, I hope so.
I'm Father Robert Ballester.
And I'm Brian Burnett.
And for the next 30 minutes, we're going to break down the knowledge of a couple of DIY projects to give it to you, to let you truly geek out. Again, with me is Mr. Brian Burnett. This is your second show as official co-host, right?
Yeah, I suppose.
Last week, you showed us a little bit of a Valentine's geeking out with what was that again?
It was an animated LED. It was the Gemma from Adafruit.
Bit Muncher.
Patent pending.
It actually got some really, really good feedback, so I'm hoping that we can do projects like that in the future.
Yeah, definitely. Anything that involves soldering, programming, a little bit of everything, I'm happy with that.
Hey, that's right. Brian Burnett, Cranky Hippo, Renaissance Man. Mm. Now, we have had a tradition of know-how, at least for the last 4 weeks, of doing feedback, where we look at our Google Plus community, because it's big, right? It's got like 6,000 users.
Oh, yeah, and growing.
Yeah, and growing. And then we bring in some of your questions, some of your concerns, and we just discuss them on the show. It's sort of our way to make sure that we're in touch with what you want to see. You want to go through some feedback?
Yeah, definitely. I think we picked through some of the best ones that we found. Do you want to start off with?
Well, not yet, though. I mean, I want to tease that a little bit. So we're going to be bringing you the very best feedback of the Google Plus group, but first I thought maybe we should talk about some freaking science.
Yeah, okay. I love science.
Have you ever heard of the Kessler syndrome?
I can't say that I have.
Okay, it's this idea that you get a sort of a chain reaction of debris in the orbits around the Earth. Like for example, let's say you had a satellite that broke apart. Mm-hmm. Those little pieces are falling at thousands of miles per hour around the Earth, and as they impact other satellites and other pieces of debris...
It's like a chain reaction.
It's like a chain reaction. It creates more shrapnel.
It's space garbage floating around.
It's space garbage. In fact, I believe we have some documentary footage of the Kessler effect, Kessler syndrome in action here. Mm-hmm. What's going on is you're seeing these little bullet-sized pieces of debris. Since they're falling so fast, even a paint fleck could have serious impact. I believe this happened like in 1988.
Right,
so,
right. They weren't using GoPros for this.
Quite good. I mean, for analog technology back
definitely.
But so we've got these usable orbits that go around the Earth, and one of the most useful orbits is the geosynchronous orbit, which runs between 35 and 36,000 kilometers.
And that's just where things keep going around.
Right. So it's falling at the same rate as the Earth. So it always looks like it's locked into the same spot around the planet. Mm-hmm. Problem is that orbit, that 35 to 36,000 kilometers above the Earth, is currently filled with 1,200, what are they calling, large debris objects.
Now, what constitute as large?
Well, you know, like old rocket boosters, dead satellites. In fact, of those 1,200 pieces, less than a third are actually functioning spacecraft, functioning satellites. Most of it's a graveyard. The problem is that, you know, way back when we started the space program, we thought space is really big, so who cares?
We're just, right. I think we had the same thought about our oceans, too.
Exactly. Yeah, a couple of boosters. But now we're seriously running into that fear that if we start a chain reaction, you could create this orbiting debris field that would keep us on the planet.
So it sounds like a pretty big problem then.
It is. It's a pain in the butt. But they've got a couple of solutions. Most of them are kind of wacky. So there was one physicist who thought, hey, you know what we should do? We should create a spacecraft that's basically like silly string. It's really, really sticky, and it just kind of sticks to other pieces of satellite and debris, and then it drags it down into
globs together.
It globs, and then you have a big blob.
You got the big blob that comes back down this from
Yeah, exactly. A big blob that comes back into the Earth and burns up. There's been another researcher who suggested that we harpoon debris.
That seems a little difficult.
Exactly.
There's got to be a better way.
Chasing the great white satellite. The problem with that is, imagine all this debris is tumbling. If you get close enough to touch it.
Oh, yeah. Then you're going to have a problem if it contacts you.
Yeah, you become space junk. You become debris, right? It's going to knock a chunk off your spacecraft or your satellite or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. So they thought about tractor beams.
I've heard about tractor beams.
What have you heard about tractor beams?
I think I saw it in Star Wars one time.
Okay, a little bit different. What they're thinking about is shooting a beam of electrons at a satellite, at a large piece of debris, and negatively charging it and having it pulled by natural attraction towards the satellite that's cleaning up.
Oh,
and
wow.
what you'll do is you'll gradually accelerate this until you get it beyond the orbit that's useful. You basically fling it off into space.
Okay.
It's not that fast.
Yeah.
You're talking about one of these spacecraft being able to maybe tow a large piece of debris out of that orbit three times a year. So you'd need a lot of these.
Yeah.
Yeah, and the tech doesn't quite exist yet. And it doesn't work at lower orbits because at lower orbits you've got plasma, which would negate the effect.
Well, I like the idea.
Yeah, the idea's good. And you know what? If we don't want to have another Sandra Bullock emergency, I think we're going to have to look at it.
How many times did you watch that movie?
Many, many, many. I had a 7-hour flight from New York to SFO, and they had the new 767 with a 27-inch monitor.
Yeah, so
I may have watched it four times.
Four times?
Yeah.
That's pretty good.
It's pretty good.
Yeah. I should probably go see it then.
You haven't seen Gravity?
Now that I know the orbital threat that we're facing, maybe I should.
And I thought we were friends.
The things you've learned.
Yeah, yeah. But you know what? Before we get to the feedback, Brian, what do you think we tell everyone about the season?
Well, you're looking quite fashionable yourself there.
Yes, yes, I like this. We are actually wearing articles of clothing from Scotty Vest, and they're the first supporter of this episode of Know How. Now, how many pieces of clothing do you actually wear that have pockets?
Ooh, probably just my pants.
Just
usually.
Your pants, right. And the problem is, if you're a geek, right? I mean, you consider yourself a geek.
Yeah.
Geeks carry lots of stuff. We've got.
You could almost call it pocket debris orbiting my body.
I like that. That's continuity. I like that. Good job. Good job. Yeah. But you see, Scotty Vest clothing is engineered to have tons of pockets because they want you to have a place to put all of your stuff.
Right. If I could steal Jason's Google Glass, I could wire it through my shirt into a battery and charge it up at the same time.
In fact, you know what? Here's what I want to do. I want to show you. This is my puffer vest. I'm not wearing it through the entire episode because it really is
a
heavy
winter vest. It would get a
little
warm in here.
Yeah, it would get a little warm. But, I mean, just, like, in this vest, I'm carrying all the essentials, everything a geek would need. Like, for example, catnip.
So okay, definitely need that on the job.
Portable speakers. And, I've got my phone and... I think I've got a backup phone here somewhere. And hard drive.
Because you want to bring that with you.
You never know when you might need that. And, this thing has more pockets than I can imagine. Now, Scotty Vest is more than just vests. They also carry high-quality hoodies, jackets, shirts, pants, and other items for men and women to carry their gadgets and in style. In fact, if you look at our model here, Mr. Burnett, you can see that they included their patented PAN, their personal area network, and they've engineered with tons of pockets that don't look just like they've added them on. They've really designed the clothing so that when you put devices into these vests, it's not going to look like you're just
right. Chunky. You don't look like you have tumors all over your body,
which I think is a bad thing.
Right. Well, one thing too, when I got this, they put business cards all over in these pockets, and I think it's almost like a treasure hunt because it's like I know they're there, but I can't. I have to figure out where the pocket is. It's a learning process.
Yeah, I talked to a Scotty Vest representative about that, and he said, one of the things we want people to do is, and this is brilliant. Yeah. The reason why they put those in there is because they want you to search
figure
for
out
it,
that you have to figure out there's a pocket. There.
Yeah, it's brilliant. I mean, that's the kind of thought that goes into making a Scotty Vest. Now, they sold over 10 million pockets and counting. They count it by the pocket. And in celebration of its 13th anniversary, Scotty Vest is running a 40% off sale for 14 of their best-selling items now through February 24th. And they've got a pickpocket guarantee that will reimburse you up to $1,000 if you're pickpocketed while wearing your brand new Scotty Vest. Their sale items include men's and women's trenches, Scotty Vest new puffer jackets, that's the one I was just wearing, fleece 7.0, cardigans, bamboo polos, performance t-shirts, and convertible travel pants, which can quickly change from full-length pants to shorts. So here's what we want you to do. Visit scottyvest.com/twit to check out the great Scotty Vest products that you can buy for 40% off during the sale. And be sure to use the promo code TWIT13 at checkout. That's TWIT13 for Scotty Vest's 13th anniversary. But you have only until 9 o'clock p.m. Mountain Time on February 24th to take advantage of this incredible sale. If you're watching or listening to this late and missed the sale, be sure to check them out anyways and use the code. Scott Jordan from Scotty Vest said he would put up other great deals just for the Twit Army, and they feature different sale items for 20% off. That's scottyvest.com, scottyvest.com/twit, and use the code TWIT13 at checkout. And we thank Scotty Vest for their support of Know How. Yeah?
Yeah. No, right. I love these things.
Feedback.
So, last week we talked about NAS and some of the drives that you would use in it. Now, one of our feedback that we got from Bjorn Rhodes?
Jorn Rhodes. Yeah, Jorn Rhodes.
Asked about the red drives. Do you want to go into that?
Yeah. So, he said, I just watched episode 80 of Know How, and you talked about the difference of drives for a NAS. There is one more very important difference, and that is firmware. The Barracuda and the Green Drive have firmware for being used as a standalone drive, which means it will try a lot harder to recover a lost sector. However, if it takes too long and makes the drive time out, most operating systems will drop the disk from the RAID and mark it as faulty. That doesn't happen with the red drive. So what happens with the red drive is because it was built specifically for a NAS, it doesn't do as rigorous of an error correction. It knows that there's other drives in the array. Now, when we did our episode about FreeNAS, Patrick and I both said, look, these are great drives for NAS, never use it in a desktop.
Yeah.
And I don't think we elaborated enough on why you shouldn't.
Now, isn't that partially because of the spin speed? It's 5600?
Well, no, I mean, the spin, the 5400 isn't 54? So bad anymore because the RL densities have increased to the point where you're plucking as much data off of it as the bus can handle.
Right.
Yeah, it's okay. That part's okay. But again, the problem is that if you put this as a standalone drive into a desktop, you risk it not doing rigorous enough error checking and losing clusters. I've actually seen this happen. I had a stack of about 10 of these things when I was in D.C., and I was gone for the month of July, and our IT person found my stack, and he started putting them into desktops. And people were reporting, well, my files are going missing. It's because when you have, like, people who just shut off their computer, just switch the power off.
Without shutting down.
It's not
so good on the drive. So it doesn't see the sectors, and then it just says, forget about it.
Yeah, later. Yeah. Okay. And you'll see that a lot. If you try to use a RAID in a standalone mode, every once in a while when you boot up Windows, you're going to see it do an error checking. And that's just because it didn't shut down.
So if you weren't to do a RAID, a regular drive, does that, and it doesn't see the files, does it throw up an error?
Like, well, no. So if you use it in a NAS, it's part of an array. Right. So there's already error checking inside the array, inside that NAS array. So it doesn't have to do it as rigorously on the drive. It could sort of give you that performance back knowing that error checking is happening down the line.
Okay.
Yeah, that's all it means.
I mean, if you're going to have something on your desktop too, I think the way to go is SSDs if you can afford it.
I love SSDs.
Once you go SSD, it's hard to go back.
It's almost impossible. And I think most people who have gone SSD and then run into that problem of my SSD is never big enough.
Yeah.
Most of the time, they'll try to run SSD and then a spinning drive for when they just need to store a lot of stuff.
Well, if you have this and an SSD, just move the extra stuff over to that. To the red.
There you go, folks. That's life experience from Mr. Cranky Hippo. Shall we go on?
Sure.
All right. We got something here from Joe Hecht. What did he want?
A universal power project. Sounds like when he was traveling for mobile power, he wanted a solution for his car or boat. But he never had a lot of options, so he put this thing together with three iPhone, iPad, 30-pin device.
Okay,
it looks
incredible.
Like you can charge anything.
Okay, Joe, first of all, let me say geek props for putting this thing together.
How do you not bust a breaker?
Yeah, how are you not dead yet? How is that not burst into flames? Now you get this, right? I mean,
yeah.
We have a lot of devices, especially here in the studio. We're always reviewing stuff. It's hard not to want a solution that will provide chargers.
That's
for
pretty cool.
Everything. It is kind of cool. But again, I don't want to be carrying around something that looks
kind of like a bomb.
Kind of, yeah.
Can you imagine not going to take that on an airplane, are you?
TSA going, sir, yeah, we had to search your bag and detonate it.
Yeah, but after we opened it, I realized we could charge anything on it.
So now we're charging ourselves. No, but we've got a different solution. This is something that I actually took a look at on Before You Buy a while back. This is an Energizer Energy to Go XP 18000. It's 18 amps. Mm-hmm. A nice thing about it is it has USB power, it's got laptop power, and it's got 12-volt power. And then it's got a series of tips. Energizer is really good for this. I mean, I also like Anker, but Energizer definitely beats them in terms of raw number of tips.
Nice.
These tips allow you to basically plug in anything that you need.
They're just little adapters, right? For different things. Yeah.
Right. So this goes to 9 volts. There's one here that will go up to 19 volts. There's another one that will give you your 5 volt, your 3 volt power.
Cool.
This wouldn't do exactly what Joe wants because he is charging so many devices. I'm not going to charge.
I don't carry that much stuff with me, but if you do, you can build a tackle box.
Right. But, I mean, you could combine this with, like, a USB hub and a couple of these adapters to charge, say, two iPads at the same time using the high current USB adapter, maybe a laptop, a couple of 12-volt devices, maybe the Raspberry Pi, all at the same time, and it would give you a good 5-6 hours of power before the cell ran dead.
That's pretty good.
That's not bad. And the nice thing about this is you can combine it with something like this. This is an energy adapter, and it can provide power either at home or in your car or in your boat. So, again, you've got a single power system with a single point of charging. It's not bad.
Does all this come with it, or do you have to kind of buy it separately, depending on your use?
You get two tips for free whenever you buy an Energizer.
That's how they get you.
That's how you
get
it.
But then
you get two free a year.
Oh.
For life.
All right. And how expensive is it?
I got one of these for like $100. Yeah, I mean, it's fun to kludge stuff together, but again, I don't like the fire hazard.
Yeah.
So, Joe.
I think you've had enough trouble with that.
Yeah, Joe, please don't kill yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Are we done with that?
I think so. So, moving on, what's the next one we had? Should I rip apart my house to run wire? I think that's referring to the Ethernet episode that we had.
Yeah, actually, if you could skip down on the next one. So we've got Brent Burnett. I'm sure no relation here.
No.
He wants to know how he should run cables in his existing walls. He wants to know, well, can you show us how to drill through walls? I could do this.
Yeah.
I could do this. I could show you how to use tape, fiberglass tape, to get down through the joists and such.
Okay.
It is a pain in the butt, but there's something else here, and that is don't.
Don't?
Don't.
Why?
Don't do it. Seriously, don't do
it. Too much trouble?
It's not that it's too much trouble. It's that to do it right, you really kind of have to rip open the walls. I've done it. I've drilled through walls. I've drilled down through the ceiling. You absolutely can do it. It will never look as neat as you want it to look. It will never work as well as you want it to work. And thank God I have never been electrocuted, but I've had friends who have used those long bits drilling down and not realizing.
And they go through something?
Yeah. So unless you know exactly where all your electrical conduits are, don't do it. Please don't do it.
So this is probably, if you're building, you're in the middle of renovating or something, then go for it. But if you have existing stuff and you're not quite sure what's behind it,
don't do it. Yeah. Okay. Can we go up one? Because we skipped
it. Sorry.
Right?
Yeah. I skipped it.
That's
my bad.
Yeah,
still getting used to this.
Yeah, it's a good gig.
All right. So this is Steve Klemczak.
I love that name. Klemczak. You know what? We're just going to call him Steve.
I'm great with people's names.
So he says, like, I hear that this group is a smart group for tech answers.
Right.
Joke's on you. No, so he said he'd give this a try. He has a Belkin router, an F7D8302 version 1, and it works fine in general. Mm-hmm. The issue he's having is that once a day he has to reboot his router to get it to work right. Okay, now, Steve, let's stop right there. If you have to reboot your router once a day,
something's not right.
It's not working fine.
Yeah.
Okay? Typically, what it means is that you've bought a cheaper router, and if they're not updating the firmware to fix this problem, you're really going to run into issues. Now, there are a couple of fixes you can try. First thing is turn everything off. I don't mean power cycle.
The modem.
Go into the router settings and turn off all those extra features.
I see.
Turn off QoS. If you're not using the Wi-Fi, turn off the Wi-Fi. Mm-hmm. Basically try to unburden the CPU, because that's what happens a lot. If the memory table gets full,
it just
drops off, right?
Okay.
It does what we call a tip over. It tips over and you have to power cycle it.
Hmm.
Right. The other thing is... Steve, I'm sorry, you got a broke-ass router. It's plain and simple. It's a broke-ass router. If that doesn't solve it, if that doesn't fix the problem, you really should look at replacing that, because that's not a problem that's going to go away.
So do you have a router that you'd recommend offhand?
Not yet. I'm waiting for Belkin to send me, Belkin Linksys. They've got a brand new WRT router that that runs DDWRT.
Oh, okay.
It's designed for open source, so they gave it a lot of memory and a lot of horsepower. It has 802.11ac. I want to see how that works. I think that's going to be my new recommendation.
Okay. Cool. Yeah. Well, maybe we can get that on the show and test it out.
Yeah, I think so. Shall we show some tools?
Yeah, let's take a look.
All right. So we've got something here from Bill Moore, who said, I saw the latest episode on home networking, and I thought I may have some noise or interference in my current wiring. So I was wondering if someone could provide specifics on the tools used for this, specifically the network tester, and also perhaps make suggestions on both the pro and non-pro tools that essentially do the same for less money.
Okay.
Bill, great. Thank you very much for saying this. Now, what I've been using are these. This is the Fluke IntelliTone toner. If you go to my product shot, these will run you about $150. They're on the nicer side. This will let you give both the cable mapping, so you can find out whether or not you made the proper cable termination. But it will also let you do a toning. If you plug this into a cable, you can then use the wand to look for the sound and figure out which wire is which. This is really important if you run a lot of cables in your premise wiring. However, if Alex will show you, there's also something you can buy on Amazon that's basically the same thing, but it costs about $6.
Right, which would be nice.
Which is nice, right. This is a no-frills network cable tester. It tells you whether or not the cable was terminated properly. Mm-hmm. It won't do any of the fancy stuff. But, if you're just doing premise wiring, $6 is a whole lot better than $150.
Yeah, and at least that way you know.
Right. Now, this is something a little different. This is a Fluke Net tool. They don't even sell this anymore. They sell the new versions. Hmm. Of course, these tools will run you between $800 and $1,500.
For that?
For this.
Wow.
Yeah, so you could get... I swear by it.
Yeah.
This is really good when I'm on a gig, because sometimes you just need a single tester that does everything.
Yeah.
But... yeah.
And so I guess once you have one of those, then you don't have to worry about it for a long, long time?
Yeah, this could be the only tool I carry with me. Typically, when I go out on a gig, I'll carry my tester, I'll carry my toner, and my termination tools, and that's about it. Now, you could use your laptop to do a lot of the testing that this does, but again, it's sometimes nice to have a self-contained unit.
Okay.
All right. Yeah. Well, how about some of the feedback that you chose?
All right. Well, I kind of went with a Raspberry Pi theme.
Oh, of course.
And one of the first ones that I had was printing from iOS and Android was a question that Leslie Longhurst asked us. And she asked, how about a segment on printing from iOS and Android? I want to print from my iPad to my existing printer, but I can't find a way to do it. I really have to buy a printer. Do I really have to buy a printer from Apple?
No.
Does Apple even make a printer?
I don't know. Right?
But if they did, I'd say don't do it, because you don't need to.
Yeah.
This might be a project that we do for a future show, but if you go to my product shot, oh, that's cool. Thank you, Alex. This is the Raspberry Pi. And what we could do is a little project that sends to the Pi, and you don't have to... This would be kind of like the little middleman.
Right, right.
We did have a sponsor on
Lantronics.
Lantronics, yeah, pretty much the same
X-Print thing. X-Print server.
The X-Print server, right. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
It depends. Yeah, if you want to pay about $100-$150, go ahead and go with the Lantronics. It's actually a really good solution. It's simple. And they're not a sponsor anymore,
But it works.
It just works.
But if you want to build your own.
If you want to build your own, and you only want to spend, maybe $40-$50.
Yeah.
Then go ahead and build yourself a Raspberry.
Yeah, so that'll probably be a future episode that we can do. Or, hey, there it is. There is an Apple printer. If that's your setup, I think you have more problems than just printing from your phone.
Yeah.
But so then the next one in the same vein was the Raspberry Pi home automation.
You really like the Raspberry Pi.
Love the Raspberry Pi. It's just so cool. But Vazzle, oh man, why do our community have they have the coolest
names,
but I have the hardest time saying them. Vazzle Kalchev?
How about Vazzle Kalchev? Just make it sound.
How about an episode about building cheap home automation with Raspberry Pi? So, and again, like future episodes, I'm actually been talking to Radford. We're talking about doing a garage door opener with a Raspberry Pi, doing a laser sensor so that when you pull your car into the garage, you know when to stop. It like activates a little LED light to tell you to stop and stuff. So that's something we're working on. It's in the future. But yeah, a lot more Raspberry Pi stuff coming up. So if anyone has any ideas or projects they want to do with the Raspberry Pi, go ahead and suggest them in our G Plus community.
And we listen to you, and we know that the Raspberry Pi episodes have been some of the highest downloaded episodes of all of KnowHow. So obviously you like it. We're going to give you more of that.
Right.
We got the right man for the job because he is Raspberry Pi crazy.
They're delicious. But so if you want to learn other things, what would you recommend if you wanted to learn some other stuff?
Well, I mean, if you wanted to learn some other stuff, I'm thinking that you might want to go with an online company that perhaps could provide you more than what we could give you in just a 30-minute joint a week.
Something curated and well shot and documented.
Yeah, because I don't want those shaky YouTube videos, right?
Oh, no.
Forget that. I want something that's professional. I want something that I could search through. I want something that has chapters so I could actually figure out what it is I want to learn before I'm actually learning it. It's just too bad that doesn't exist.
Wait a second, Padre. I think it does.
What?
And we should tell our viewers about it.
All right.
Lynda.com.
You know what? I got a sheet here for them. How about that? Now, what do you want to learn? You want to learn photography, audio and video editing, software skills? With the easy-to-follow video tutorials on Lynda.com, you can learn at your own pace, on your own terms, from top industry experts. With a Lynda.com subscription, members receive unlimited access to thousands of online video courses that cover a variety of software, creative, and business skills. Now, I've been relearning Adobe Premiere all over again. I mean, I know how to use Premiere, but Brian, back me on this. When you're doing it in the real world, you often fall into the trap of there's like six or seven functions that that you use all the time.
You get comfortable.
Just cut, paste, transition, blah, blah,
and
blah, blah.
And then something comes up, a project here, or something comes up, and you're like, oh, I should really know how to do this. Lynda.
Lynda, right. Because it makes me feel horrible when I'm not using the full capacity of my software.
And then you can kind
software.
Of brush up on stuff, too.
Right,
like,
right.
Oh, yeah, I totally forgot that you could do that in Final Cut.
It's a no-guilt, no-risk way to make sure that you're current on all your skills and knowledge. Now, with Lynda, you get to improve your skills, learn new software, and keep up with technology. They have over 2,000 courses with new courses added daily. Their new courses this week include building an office online community, Pro Tools mixing and mastering, the art of Photoshop composition, Maya tips and tricks, UX design techniques, ideation, and Excel 2013 macros in depth. Their instructors are working professionals at the top of their fields and expert teachers. They have high-quality video productions. This is what I was talking about before. They make their videos in high-quality art studios. These aren't homemade videos you'll find on YouTube with bad lighting and bad audio. Their curated course content is tops. Each Lynda.com course is carefully structured so that users can learn from start to finish or jump to a specific chapter for quick answers. They have easy-to-follow videos that can help you find the answers you need, and they have searchable transcripts, even allowing you to search inside a video to save time and find exactly what you're looking for. Courses for all experience levels that cover a wide range of technical skills are part of Lynda's purview. They have creative techniques, business strategies, and more, and they let you watch from your computer, your tablet, or your mobile device. You can switch and pick up on the chapter where you left off. In other words, learn at your own pace, on your own schedule, anytime you want. So here's what we want the know-it-alls to do. We want you to learn something new in 2014 with Lynda.com. It's only $25 a month for access to the entire Lynda.com library, or for $37.50 a month, you can subscribe to the premium plan, which includes exercise files that let you follow along with the instructor's projects using the exact same assets. And you can try Lynda.com free right now for 7 days. Visit Lynda.com/knowhow to access the entire library. That's over 2,000 courses free for 7 days. That's Lynda.com/knowhow. And we thank Lynda for their support of KnowHow.
Cool.
Yeah. Now, Brian, Have you ever had that issue where you type in a web address and, like, it hesitates or it stutters and maybe it times out and you have to type it again and then it works just fine and you haven't figured out what's going on?
It's a pain.
It's a pain.
I deal with it, but is there a way to fix it?
There is. I thought maybe it might be time to show you how to fix DNS. DNS stands for Domain Name System, and it's how your computer finds things on the internet. You see, if you open up a browser and type www.google.com into the address bar, that in and of itself doesn't actually mean anything to any of the routers that route traffic on the internet. They need an actual IP address, that address that tells them where to send packets, where it should go, and to what router it should go next. The way it works if you actually type google.com into your address bar is that you go through what's called the domain name system. You see, your computer will query a DNS server and ask it for the IP address of the server that you've requested. In the case of google.com, the DNS server would look up google.com and find that it relates to an IP address of 74.125.239.41. It can then stamp the packets with that address, and those packets go off into the internet through the routers to the final destination of Google, where it's responded to and then sent back to you. Bing, bang, boom, instant Doge video. The problem is that it doesn't always work that way. You see, not all DNS servers are created equal. Some, like the ones run by less diligent ISPs, may be a little bit oversubscribed. Too many subscribers, too many people hitting them, and that means that they're not as reliable and they're a little slow to respond. Now, if they're slow to respond, if they're slow to convert that google.com into the IP address, that means your packets don't go out as quickly. If your packets don't go out as quickly, it means they don't get routed as quickly. If they don't get routed as quickly, it means that you don't get responded to as quickly. And that means, so frustration, much slow, bad, bad Doge. Wow. If you want to know how fast your DNS server is running, I suggest using Steve Gibson's DNS benchmarking tool. The link will be in the show notes. His software will allow you to benchmark over 200 DNS servers at a time, giving you a pretty good idea of how your DNS server stacks up. What we're looking for is a combination of reliability and low response time. It's going to vary from region to region and user to user, but most of us, I would bet, are going to find that the ISP server is not the fastest one that we can access. You've probably even noticed it before. You know when you typed in an address into the browser window and then you waited and waited and waited and waited until finally you got so fed up that you retyped it or hit enter? Or maybe that time that it seemed like a resource, a server was unavailable, and then miraculously it popped back the next moment. Well, in all likelihood, that was a DNS problem. Luckily, you don't have to live with a slow DNS server. You can, and you probably should, change them to increase your performance, your reliability, and even add a couple of non-performance security-based advancements. But you need to find out where your DNS settings live. Now, it's going to be different from operating system to operating system, so I'm going to show you how to do it in two different ones, Windows 7 and OS 10. Now, the instructions I'm giving you will also work for Windows 8, but you're going to have to figure out how to do it with that weird, new, modern UI. Meh. In Windows 7, go to Start, Control Panel, Network and Sharing Center, then click Local Area Connection. You'll get a pop-up window for local area connection status. Now click Properties. Select Internet Protocol Version 4 and click Properties once again. Towards the bottom of this new window, you'll see an option to use the following DNS server addresses. Enable that selection and then type in your two favorite DNS servers. My personal choices are Google's DNS server at 8.8.4.4 and OpenDNS at 208.67.222.222. Select OK, close, close, and you're good. Your computer will now use those third-party DNS servers instead of your ISPs. Now, quick note, the instructions that I just gave you will add the third-party DNS server to the wired connection. But if you have multiple connections on your computer, say the wired, maybe a second wired, a dual LAN, or a Wi-Fi connection, you're going to have to change the settings in those connections as well. In Mac OS X, you need to go into the System Preferences and select Network. You select the connection that you want to configure, be it Ethernet or Wi-Fi, then select Advanced. Choose the DNS tab, and at the bottom of the DNS servers box, you'll find the plus sign, which will allow you to add your own DNS server configuration. Add as many DNS servers as you'd like. In my case, I'm adding Google and OpenDNS. Then click OK and apply. I know that some of you want the convenience and the performance of having a third-party DNS server, but without the hassle of having to put those settings into every device that you own. So if your router is even a little not crap, you can change the settings of the DHCP server built within the router to automatically give those settings to every device that comes onto your network and requests an address. I know that sounds like a lot of technobabble, but stay with me. Log into your router and find the section that controls the DHCP settings. You should see fields that allow you to define static DNS servers. If you input your preferred DNS servers here, devices that connect to your network will automatically be given those DNS settings. Now, granted that it's easier to do this method because the settings are automatically inherited by any device that connects to your network, but the advantage of hard coding the DNS server information is that you keep it, no matter what network you're connected to. So even if you're not at home, if you're on a public Wi-Fi network, or if you're in a campus network, you'll always have the advantage of that third-party DNS. Now, for those of you whose browsing habits are, let's say, more defined, and by more defined, I mean that you use the same 10 to 20 sites over and over, there is one little trick that you can use to speed up your DNS resolution even more, and that involves editing your host file. Both Windows and OS X computers have a host file that allows you to map or hard code a name to a IP address. That means that when you type that name into your browser, your computer doesn't have to go to a DNS server to resolve it because the IP address is contained within that host file. For Windows 7 users, the process is straightforward. First, open Notepad in administrative mode by going to Start, All Programs, Accessories, then hover your mouse over Notepad and right-click. From the drop-down menu, choose Run as Administrator. You'll be asked to verify that you want to allow the program to make the changes to your computer. Go ahead, accept, and continue. Now open a file with Notepad and navigate to the folder with the hosts file. You can find it at My Computer, C, Windows, System 32, Drivers, etc. You need to make sure that Notepad is seeing all files by clicking on the selection box next to the file name field and selecting all files. You will now be able to see the host's file. Open the host file and go to the bottom of the file. Add your DNS entry in the following format: IP address, tab, and then the URL. I'm going to enter the IP address of 74.125.239.41 and then give it the value of google.com. Repeat this process for all your favorite websites, remembering that the easiest way to get the IP address of a server is to use the integrated ping command. Go to Start and open a command shell by typing cmd into the Search Programs and Files bar and hitting Enter. Now type ping and the name of the site for which you want the IP address. For example, irc.twit.tv. The ping tool will return the value of 174.37.23.130 in our example, and I can now put that value into the host file next to irc.twit.tv. The fun thing about this method is that you don't have to put a real site, or you could readdress a site that actually exists. For example, I'm going to use the Google IP address of 74.125.239.41 and the made-up URL of crankyhippoisabaddoge.com, as well as the irc.twit.tv IP address of 174.37.23.130, and the value of a.tv. Now when you go to a browser and type crankyhippoisabaddoge.com, it will direct to google.com, and a.tv will end up at the Twit IRC channel. I should note that this will definitely speed up your resolving, but remember that you've now hard-coded those IP addresses to those URLs. If the IP address ever changes in the real world, you will no longer be able to reach those servers until you update the host file or just remove those IP addresses from the host file altogether. Also, some servers don't respond on their default pinged IP address, so you really want to try and see, make sure that all the servers you need to reach, you can actually reach. For users of OS X, the host file can be found in the private /etc folder. Just hit Command-Shift-G, then type /private /etc, and hit Enter.
You can use your command line-based editor of choice like Pico, Nano, or VI. And remember that the same format and rules apply as to Windows. Follow these simple steps and DNS will no longer be the Achilles heel of your internet experience.
So you know, actually, the know-it-alls had a really good point. Why are you on the show if you're a bad doge?
I snuck my way onto the show.
That's how bad doge I am.
Yeah.
Now, I know that that was a lot of material. I'm sorry. We started with something easy. Replacing DNS servers is easy. Then we get a bit more difficult. And then towards the end, yeah, if you're going to do that, just make sure you have a little bit of experience before you mess around with the host file. Because if you do it wrong, you can really screw yourself up.
Yeah, well, I like the way you ramp up the difficulty as you go along.
That's how we go. And I know, again, it was a long segment, but really DNS is the weak point of the internet right now. So anything you can do to get rid of that vulnerability, that's a good thing.
And if people wanted to learn more about DNS, is there a show that they could watch here?
Yeah, well, I think they could go to our show note pages, actually, where they'll also tell you to go to a show called Twiet, which is This Week in Enterprise Tech.
I've never heard of it.
It was weird, right? I know. It's on Mondays at 2:30 p.m. I don't know. You just may want to check it out every once in a while. But barring that, we do have show notes for this show. If you have questions about any of the answers that we gave you for the feedback, if you want to know where the story about the tractor beam came from, if you want the actual step-by-step instructions on how to fix your DNS, just go to, where's that, Brian?
twit.tv/KH.
That's right, twit.tv/KH. And while you're there, you'll also find a way to subscribe to the show. You can have the show automatically downloaded into your device of choice, be it your iPad or your iPhone, your Android tablet, your laptop, your desktop, whatever it may be. Now, if you want to contact us, if you want to find out what's going on in a future episode of Know How, if you want to suggest a topic for us to put into a future episode of Know How, just go ahead and I'd say the best way to get us would be on our Google Plus page, right?
Yeah, the Google Plus community. There's almost 6,000 people
on
that now.
It's rising. Yeah.
Our link is working now. Last week it wasn't. gplus.to/twitkh. Yeah.
Which, by the way, we didn't do anything. We didn't switch any parameters. It just started working again. So Google, whatever you're doing, thank you so very much for doing that. Now, if you're not going to follow us on Google Plus, if you hate Google Plus, you could also reach out to us on Twitter. That's probably the easiest way to get a hold of me. I'm Padre SJ. That's at Padre SJ.
And I'm Cranky_Hippo.
That's right. And, well, now that you know how,
go do it.